This is Dear Analyst, episode number 89. I'm super excited today to be talking with David Jayatilika. He is the co-founder at Avora, where he is also the chief product and strategy officer. And I'll have him talk more about what he does and what Avora does in a bit. David, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm hoping to have a good time.
Perfect. Well, yeah, I guess why don't we just get started and can you tell us more about your background, what you've done in the past, and what you currently do at Avora?
So my background is as a data practitioner. So I've spent probably 12 years in data up till now, before becoming a co-founder. So I've built different data teams and worked in different industries like e-commerce, credit, fintech, payments. So a few different spaces. And I've built different teams, including analytics engineering, analytics, data engineering, data science, mostly focused on analytics engineering and analytics. So in my new role, so Avora is a business reliability tool that sits on top of metrics layer. So we have a kind of a basic one of our own, but we're looking to sit on top of other ones like DBT and Transform and Cube in the future. And so what we do is we allow businesses to understand why their metrics have changed and when they've changed in a material way that's, you know, truly material.
Gotcha. I guess, you know, you're off doing your own thing now. What led you to want to start Avora after your previous 12 years working with different companies?
So Avora existed before I joined, and I've been an advisor there for some time. So I know my co-founder there I've known him for a number of years. So we kind of have that we've got a relationship that's pretty like well set up for co-founding already, as being an advisor who could kind of be very, you know, be very candid, and we can be very open with each other. So we're kind of really in a good place to co-found together.
Got it. Okay. So you obviously have a ton of experience building data teams, leading data teams, and you now are a co-founder and in a kind of product and strategy role. I'm curious, what has the transition been like from working at different companies to now leading product strategy and basically everything for this company, this new company?
Sure. It's almost like stepping over the desk, because if you think as someone who leads data teams, naturally you end up with doing a fair bit of vendor management, whether that's for your data warehouse, your BI tool, your anomaly detection tool like Avora, your ELT tool like Fivetran, right? You're used to dealing with these vendors and knowing what you want from them, what you want them to deliver in your stack. So in some ways, you're thinking about those products from what you want from it as a customer. And I think that's like really invaluable as to why you can then step over the desk and sit in product shoes in like a data SaaS company. And there's a few of us doing those kind of roles, like Claire Carroll moving into being leading products at Hex. Like, you know, it's becoming quite common.
Got it. So is it kind of like you, throughout your experience using these different tools, you've maybe started seeing features you want to see in a tool, and I guess ultimately there's enough kind of features where you're like, why don't I just go ahead and build the tool that I want? Is that kind of the story you're kind of?
Yeah, exactly. And like with Avora, I've been advising them from a product point of view for a number of years. So I've been telling them to build this feature and this is how it should look. And so it's kind of quite a natural, it hasn't felt very unnatural for me. It's just an extension of what I've been doing.
Okay. And was, I'm sure there's a lot of crossover between the skills you need from a data perspective to the skills you need as in a product manager role, a product leader role. Were there any new skills that you had to learn or gain as you became more of a product person?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky in that I have a product manager at Avora who I've worked with for a number of years, also as a customer. So I've seen how he's operated, this guy called Tessima. And because of that, I haven't had to like learn how to do the whole like product discipline. Like, so I had a chat with Katie Heinzen from Lightdash recently about how did you learn how to do the product discipline from coming from a, you know, or more or less identical background to me. And it was quite interesting. Whereas for me, I do need to learn those things, like how to run a stand-up, how to build a product roadmap, all those kind of things. But I have a lot of help.
Got it. Cool. So you're just kind of relying on existing product leaders and managers within the organization.
Yeah.
Cool. And I know you've kind of struck out into publishing a great newsletter on Substack and took a read through some of those posts. And one of the posts that I really stuck out to me was this one on bundling and unbundling. And I'm curious, can you explain what that means in the context of a data team and also how that affects today's data engineer who is also thinking about whatever. I'll let you explain more, but curious how this also affects the data engineer's responsibilities.
Sure. So unbundling and rebundling. I was on the analytics engineering podcast recently with Ben Stansel and Tristan talking about this exact topic. And I think as Ben described it, he said, we've detonated a bomb inside the data stack, and it's turned into like many, many fragments. And yes, I believe that is true to an extent. And the drivers behind that are things like the advent of cloud, things like dbt coming about and enabling smaller tools to interact in the chain. I think what's happened was in the past you had stacks like Microsoft, IBM, Teradata, Oracle, which were like whole stacks for doing. They weren't very well suited for analytics, to be fair, but they offered analytics stack that was, you know, somewhat complete, and people would just use that stack and nothing else. And if they couldn't do something with it, they just didn't, or they'd do it manually. And what's happened now is I think the cloud vendors and people like Snowflake and Databricks came out with cloud data warehouses, and they didn't build the rest of the ecosystem around them. They haven't really built, like, I mean, maybe Google is a bit of an exception in that they've bought some of these tools that are needed around it, but they don't have great extract and load tools in general as part of their offering. They don't have a transform layer like dbt, for example, most of the time. Google, again, exception. And, you know, they don't necessarily have a BI tool that's particularly good. So, for example, like AWS QuickSight and Google's Data Studio, they're functional tools, but they're not market leading. And, you know, that's, you know, you can see that partly behind the reason why Google bought Looker. So you've got this fragmented stack of different tools from different providers. And in addition to that, I think like the quantity of data having to be dealt with and the rate of change in data of different use cases coming about in businesses has led to a need for things, new categories like data observability, a greater need for cataloging than before, like, you know, tools like Atlan offering discoverability and metadata management. You know, that wasn't such a big deal when I started my career, because you'd learn what your, you know, main 10 to 20 tables that you needed to do your job were from like the current analyst when you joined the company. And now, you know, you've got companies like, say, Monzo, who have nearly, you know, I think at last count 4,000 dbt models, like that representing tables.
Wow.
You know, there's this scale of requirement for knowledge sharing and metadata management and monitoring. And it's following the route that software development has taken, and therefore needing, you know, a lot of similar but data specific tooling.
And I suppose when you say bundling, like, let's say the cloud vendors or Databricks, they now incorporate some of these other tools like ETL, Transform Layer into their tools, that now becomes a big bundle, which could, I guess there could be a fear that it becomes the next kind of Oracle. Is that a valid fear, or is that not really what where the market you think could be heading?
I don't think any of them are powerful enough to do that. I think, because imagine if, say, Google said, oh, BigQuery, Looker only now works with BigQuery, and whatever else only works with BigQuery. And if you want to use BigQuery, you have to use these tools. Or if you want to use these tools, you have to use BigQuery. Now, if they did that, there is still Snowflake, there is still Redshift, there is still Synapse, there is still Databricks that other people can go to and then use a broader and more open stack. So I don't think any of them are powerful enough to do that at this point, which is good. but yes, in theory, if they were, you could end up with a stack that's much more closed. But the problem with it is, I think you'll end up in a similar situation to what we had when we had those big four stacks before the cloud, in that they maybe sold for 80% of use cases, and then the remaining 20% didn't work very well. And they, you know, some of these larger organizations, they have, you know, really big goals. And let's say for a cloud vendor, you know, the main goals for them are selling compute and storage, right? So that's not necessarily aligned with building a fantastic data product.
Got it. And can you think of any projects that you've worked on in the past with data teams where, I guess, the unbundling of analytics tools was an issue, and then like what the engineering team had to do to like build custom solutions or custom pipelines? I'm curious what kind of projects and issues that has caused you and your teams in the past.
So this is interesting, because I feel like unbundling generally means that you don't have to build custom solutions. So mm-hmm. when I first joined List, they had Redshift and Looker and some custom Python scripts doing some of their more complex transformations. So I replaced Redshift and those Python scripts with dbt and Snowflake. So in theory, I replaced something that was custom with another unbundled solution,
mm-hmm.
but that actually made things easier. It made it easier to maintain. It was quicker to develop on. And so the unbundling that I've seen hasn't been painful as long as it's well integrated. So then we also had Monte Carlo there. Our stack actually increased in terms of number of things in it quite significantly during my time there, but it didn't feel like it was difficult to manage, or that we ended up doing more custom things, because the way we chose the stack were things that interoperated together well.
I see. So like there were kind of like natural integrations between dbt and the tools you're implementing. So it didn't feel like, you know, you have this like random tool here, random tool there.
Yeah. So like things like Monte Carlo integrated with Looker and dbt and Snowflake, right? So we'd get, you know, there wasn't some extra thing we had to do to push metadata in. Dbt obviously sat on top of Snowflake. Out of the box, like we didn't have to build any custom thing to make it connect to Snowflake. That's just part of what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly didn't feel like it increased data engineering complexity.
Got it. Yeah, that's a really interesting example. And I'll definitely include some more notes about these different platforms you mentioned. Shifting gears a little bit to, I suppose, organizational management, organizational behavior. I read another one of your articles about the difference. I think you mentioned the differences between work and line management. Could you explain what that distinction is and how you've seen it implemented or executed, or how you've implemented or executed it in your teams?
Yeah, so I think it's a good place to start is probably, let's think about like a typical hierarchically organized organization. So in those organizations, a line manager is quite broad. The line manager is responsible for what work their team is doing and managing that workflow. So a bit of a project manager, if you think in that sense. They're also responsible for like career coaching and development of their direct reports. And then they're also responsible for mentoring those direct reports and like helping them get to the skill levels that they need to. So those are like three distinct activities in my mind. Mm-hmm. Now, quite a few organizations have already stripped the project management piece out. And typically you find like tech companies have product managers who lead squads or teams of engineers and analysts and data people. And those product managers are in charge of what work we should be doing and prioritization and things like that. So you've already stripped out that piece, but I think the remaining piece of line management is then, you know, career coaching and mentoring that's stuck together and that's continues to be stuck together. And actually those skills are quite different. I've spoken to like many engineers who are really happy mentoring junior engineers and helping them grow, but they don't want to be responsible for helping them get promoted or get a pay rise and coaching them to how they get there and navigate the organization. They have no interest in that. So I think there's a real value in splitting those two things, because suddenly you get access to a much larger pool of mentors. And then you can actually have people who are specialists in career coaching. Those could be HR people, really. Like, so I've learned to do all three things in my career, but you know, I believe if you split it more, I think there's almost like greater flexibility that you can get from it.
Got it. So they're the line manager, you're saying, could be split into two different roles, career coaching and mentorship. And yeah, the mentors, there could be many more, I suppose, mentors within an organization. Yes. Because they're not directly responsible for that person getting promoted, finding a new position, so on and so forth.
And there can be many more career coaches as well, right? Because it opens it up to people like, say, HR business partners to being those career coaches as well, because they're perfectly, you know, qualified to do that for most people.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen this being, or how have you implemented this in your previous teams, or how has the feedback been with this new type of model?
So I've not been able to officially implement the splitting of career coaching and mentoring. We've done it unofficially with some people who weren't line managers being mentors for people. But I almost feel like it's better if it was officially acknowledged. I think it allows people to develop in those ways and to get to be rewarded for it. Because quite often now, mentors just do it, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really get anything for it. Whereas people who do the career coaching part, people who do the workflow management part do get rewarded for it.
Got it. I think you mentioned this earlier, you were on the Analytics Engineering podcast, and I think you also wrote a post in the podcast, you talked about the differences between an analyst and an analytics engineer. And I think the analytics engineer to me is kind of a relatively new role I've seen pop up in the last year or two.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if there are other roles appearing in the data space that analysts should think about transitioning to if they want to expand their analytical skills or expand their business skills. I'm curious if you have a pulse on what type of roles are emerging or appearing within the data organization.
That's the thing. I think I've seen the analytics engineer role come out, and I feel like there's quite a nice, well-defined, almost like relay race of like feature engineer in the product team, whether that's back-end or front-end, data engineer, analytics engineer, sometimes not even needing the data engineer, depending on what tooling's in place and standardization,
mm-hmm.
Analyst or data scientist then using that data. And I feel like that's covering most of what's needed. What I'm seeing though is analyst specialization. So you're seeing analysts focusing on like every area that a business has. So finance, revenue, marketing, product, all those different areas, departments of a business, even HR. You see that now, HR analysts, especially at large organizations. So I think that's where And then we have analytics. I've had analytics engineers deployed in those areas as well. You can also get specialism by product as well. So inside an organization, if let's say for example, at List we had teams that were focusing on building our checkout product. So we could have analysts or analytics engineers focused on that checkout product as well.
Right. And then I suppose, but there still needs to, I guess, would there be data engineers specifically on that product team? Because I could feel like if there are data engineers for different products, there has to be some underlying data team that ties all of the data for the in the organization together somehow. So I'm guessing there it can't be too specialized, if that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can end up too specialized. And I think that's where, if you take like this concept of data mesh too far and everyone's specialized and separate, you end up with without a lot of care, you end up with like incongruent methods and tools being used. So one good thing that can solve for that is having like a hub and spoke model, where you have some central resource and they're mostly focused on, infrastructure and how things should be done and what tools should be used. And then you have the domain specialist spokes who then use that to deliver value for stakeholders.
Got it. That makes sense. I think back in my day, being an analyst was just being good at Excel, and I used to work in finance. So you just said, as long as you're good with Excel and finance, it was kind of understood that, oh, you could be an analyst for a sales team or an analyst for an operations team, because Excel was kind of the underlying tool that made you special, so to speak. But now there are so many other tools that you can specialize in on the product side, on a functional side. To your point, you can now specialize more as an analyst.
Like you see like product analysts who are like specialists with like Amplitude and Mixpanel, and you've got marketing analysts, and this has been true for a while for them to be great at Google Analytics and things like that. And then so you have like revenue and finance analysts who are now really good at those specific data sets as well.
Right. I guess kind of to wrap things up, more of like a fun question. I know you started the Substack. Was it earlier this year or maybe a few months ago?
It was at the start of January, yeah.
Got it. Yeah. What are you hoping to accomplish? Any goals for the newsletter? I feel like I've seen more people in the product and data space starting to publish newsletters. I know Ben Stancil, I think he has a blog that he updates once in a while. It's always interesting to see people just starting to be more public with their projects, analyses, et cetera.
Ben's is also a Substack, and actually it was him, he threw down a gauntlet at the end of last year to like inspire some other people to write. And I was actually considering writing about a career, like the career transitions I was going through. And so I thought, oh, he's just throwing down this gauntlet, I better take it up, but especially given that I was considering doing it. So I did it. And the main motivation for me is, I've really benefited from being in the data space. And part of what I want from it is to give back and to share my knowledge with some other people. The data communities that we've got now are so strong and large, and really they're great communities that we didn't used to have before. And yeah, that's a big reason for me. The other reason, I guess, for me is like I feel like it codifies my own thoughts and my own it helps me think about how to solve things as well by writing about them.
Got it. Yeah, I think being able to write clearly and concisely and tell a story about data is like a skill that I think a lot of people are trying to learn. So I think what you're showing is how you can do this at a very high level. So definitely we'll be following the Substack and also including it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and honestly, if I can do it, anyone could do it. I'm really not the most eloquent person or the best writer, and it's helping me improve in that way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think same thing goes for this podcast and newsletter. Helps me think about what's going on in the world and how to organize my thoughts as well. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. This is really interesting, and I have a lot bunch of notes, and I'm definitely excited to share this with the community. And thank you again for being on Dear Analyst.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.